It's kind of a devastatingly sad choice to make as a player for your characters, to give them an incredibly meaningful but unattainable errand.
I have hope in my heart that it'll be positive, but there's the thoughts in my head that are like, you know, I've set this character up to do nothing but go down. As a hero, if you live too long, you become the villain. No, I'll come across some fragment of a note and I'm like, what did I mean by Waffle King? Who's the Waffle King? What am I talking about, Waffle King?
Hello, friends. Welcome to Characters Without Stories, a TTRPG podcast about the roads not yet traveled. I'm Star. This episode, I'm joined by Glenn Bittner, a tabletop gamer since the 70s and an almost always forever GM. He has been working on the retail side of the gaming industry for the last 16 years and has a self-published RPG called Mistrunner. Glenn, I will give you a chance to plug your projects at the end, but right now, do you want to tell listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, as you mentioned, I've been working in the retail side of the industry. I've been running game stores for the last decade and a half, roughly. Love what I do. I get to sell, I sell fun. And then despite what people think, I don't play games all day, but I get to introduce a lot of people to games, whether they're already gamers or not. I get to introduce them possibly something they haven't played before. And one of the things I pride myself on is our RPG selection. Of course, we have D&D because if you're a game store, you're going to sell D&D most likely, but I have curated a collection of easily 50 different, at any one time, 50 different indie RPGs we have in the store. So I like showing off all the different things that people can do with games and just working to build a bigger and better community.
Yeah. Glenn, you and I met on TikTok, and your content, a lot of it is about all of these other amazing TTRPGs that are available. And you've also, on my Discord, have actually run games and have recommended playing a lot of games. And I really enjoy that. It's great to discover new games.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things. Since I was first introduced in the late 70s to D&D and then eventually to other games, I've always sought out other titles because I have a lot of varied interests. And I want to try and experience new things as often as I can.
Yeah, definitely. So today we're talking about a character built for a game called Vassin. Can you tell me a little bit more about that game?
So Vassin is Nordic horror. It's set kind of during the 17, 1800s. Initially, it was primarily set in Scandinavian countries. The main setting takes place in Sweden, but they've since introduced a Celtic and British book, which is the one that my character has been mostly playing through. Or in that setting. So it's all about the coming industrial age mixing with the mythological and how those two will butt heads and how the two worlds are, you know, our world is changing and it's kind of pushing this old world out. And then you're part of the society that deals with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting to me. I think a lot of the literature that came out around that time period at the beginning of the industrial age, and a lot of it is about kind of similar themes as in Vassin, you know, this kind of traditional folkloric versus this modern industrial age. Like I think of Dracula, for example.
You don't have to use it, but in our games we do. It's also the way that Europe changing from as it becomes more industrialized and as more and more people move to the cities, how it's becoming more and more Christian nations than it is the old beliefs. And that, again, it's that conflict that causes, because a lot of the Vassin are not big fans of Christianity. Mm. Probably because, you know, Christianity tends to burn people who don't like it. So
right. Yeah. I think it's a really fruitful, really interesting theme to set a gaming world in. I'd say also, having looked at the game a little bit, that it shares some kind of commonalities with games like Call of Cthulhu or Monster of the Week, and that you're investigating monsters. Would you say that that's like kind of the primary goal in this game?
Definitely, that is the main goal. You actually are members of what's called the Society, and you investigate occurrences with Vason. And one of the things I love about it is that it's not simply a find and kill type mission. It is always the investigate, find out what's going on, and then come to a solution, which on some occasions does mean killing whatever is involved. But a lot of times it means trying to find some way to smooth things over between the, which is most often the human populace and whatever Vesson is in the area. Because the Vesson in general are not necessarily evil. They're just different. I mean, some are evil, just like people. Some of them are evil, but it is all finding out what caused this problem to begin with and how can you fix that and address that problem.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think there's a lot of media, including games, that deal with monsters as being just 100% evil, and it just makes it easier for us to kill them. And I love it when a game or a piece of media complicates that story. So, Glenn, tell me, who are you bringing to the table today?
Character is actually the first character I made for the game, about 2-ish years ago or so. Montgomery Whitlow. That is the name he goes by now. He had another name that he no longer uses because he had a falling out with his family. But he was not really an aristocrat, but came from a family that had some money. Left it all behind. He joined the Society because he has what is called the sight, meaning he can see and interact with Vason, which most people cannot generally unless the Vason want to be seen. And he has kind of made it his mission to understand this other world better and to come to grips as well with his past, because the experiences he had when he was a younger man and a child that introduced him to this other world really shaped and changed him in a way that he wants to try to come to peaceful solutions as often as possible with these other world creatures.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting when looking at the rules for this game. The sight is an interesting idea. From what I read, the ability to see the Vason comes out of perhaps a trauma. Why does Monty have the sight?
Like I said, Monty came from not really aristocracy, but he came from a little bit of money. His family had an estate, and he, you know, obviously grew up there. Monty is not exactly what one would call a handsome fellow. He had an accident when he was a child that left a very large scar across the left side of his face. So that meant that, you know, his potential as a husband was greatly diminished. And there was a young girl who lived on the estate who was kind of a servant in a way. And they kind of grew up together. And as what happens with two young people who spend a lot of time together, they fell in love. And they made all these plans and stuff like that. And there was something that kind of was eating away at Monty, in that as happy as she would be at times, his wife, a wife-to-be, Thay, there was like a sadness in her eyes all the time, like a longing for something else. And he asked his mother about it because his mother is, you know, who hired the girl or brought her in when she was a child, and could never get a straight answer. And after much digging, he found in the attic, he found an old trunk. And inside the trunk, he found a seal skin. And he wasn't really quite sure what that meant. And when he showed it to Thay, she was overjoyed because she is a Selkie. And her mother had found her when she was a child. She was on a beach with her mother, and her mother took her skin. And as long as you have the Selkie skin, they can't change back into a seal. And she had basically been a prisoner all this time. Now, Monty feels awful about this. And, you know, he's conflicted because he loves this woman, but he also doesn't want to, you know, keep her here against her will. So he offers the sealskin back to her. And initially, she takes it, but they stay together. She doesn't leave the farm. And they eventually do get married. But with her sealskin back, the call for her to return to the sea becomes stronger and stronger and stronger until one day she does finally decide to leave him. And at this point, they have a daughter. and she takes the daughter with her and leaves. She tells Monty this, and Monty is accepting of it, though he's incredibly sad. And that now he is constantly trying to find a way to reunite himself with his family. He's not just seeking out Vesson so he can understand them because of his upbringing and his connection with this woman. He wants to see if he can find a way to, in essence, join her in her world. And that's what really drives him, because he's had that this love of his life taken away from him. And also the fact that his mother basically kept this prisoner in the house. He's pretty sure she still loved him because she stayed even after he gave the skin back. But there was always that lingering thing of the how much of that was love and how much of that was just simply her adapting the condition that she was raised in.
That's a difficult place to be in emotionally.
Yeah. And I should note that this game, the subject matter of it is very adult. There's a lot of heavy themes. The consent sheet for this, a lot of people would look at it and be like, it's a little too much for me. There's a lot of stuff that goes on, because this one was originally started, the person who runs the game, they started doing role-playing games as a way for them to deal with, they had a very bad upbringing as a child, assault and all that type of stuff. And this is, role-playing games was their way of dealing with those issues and talking about those issues in a way that she was more comfortable with. So we run a lot of very heavy, heavy themed games when she runs.
Interesting. I know there's been a lot of discourse about how much of our real life issues we take into our games. How do you feel about that, about kind of taking these experiences and working through them at the gaming table?
I think as long as everyone at the table knows what's happening and is on board with it, it's great. It's fine. It's not something you want to slip into a game without telling anyone, especially if it's dealing with any kind of trauma. Because, I mean, you don't know what everyone else is bringing to the table with them. So if you suddenly just throw in something about, child abuse, and someone else at the table has gone through that, but they don't want this coming out in the game. This is their escape from that. That would be a bad thing. But I think, using your safety tools, using consent forms and stuff like that can lead to good experiences for everyone involved.
Yeah, I can't overstate that safety tools are the only thing that really make playing games like that any fun. Like, I don't want to play Call of Cthulhu or something like that that's really dark without having done a consent form and having had that discussion. Even I'm playing a very lighthearted D&D game right now, and we still did it because it's important.
Yeah. And this game also showed me something that I had never experienced before, but the game master at times will throw an X card in that game because it gets a little too heavy for her. And I've never experienced that from a game master before, where they say, all right, hold on, we're going to pull back from this topic a bit because it's getting to be a bit too much.
Yeah.
And that was really interesting because I'd never thought of it that, oh yeah, if I'm running a game, I'm also playing.
Right.
I should have the same safety and comfort as everyone else.
Yeah. If you're listening and you're a game master, please let this empower you to treat your own safety at the same way that you treat your player's safety.
Yep. It's often overlooked.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So how old is Monty when he begins his career as a member of the society?
Monty is in his late 20s when he begins.
So is he a newlywed at this point, or has he been married for a while?
When he joins society, it's about a year after Faye and his daughter left him. Now he's in his 30s, because it's been several years that he's been a member. So
you're starting the story with him having a lot of familiarity with the society.
A fair amount. By the time you start, generally, you were either already a member of the society or you're just joining. But like Monty did, he did a lot of searching on his own. The society ended up finding him because of all the places he was digging and investigating. He crossed paths with them enough times where they're like, all right, we either have to deal with this guy or bring him on board.
So what was he doing to cross paths with them before he was a member of the society?
Well, the society investigates mysterious happenings, and that's the same thing Monty was doing. And Monty has a much lighter touch than a lot of other society members do, because his first and foremost action is to come to a peaceful resolution. And not everyone in the society shares the same thoughts. On top of the fact that sometimes a peaceful resolution is not possible, because there are some messages like people that they just want to cause harm. And sometimes you have to deal with them a bit more harshly, but Monty is very reluctant to do that. Even though he is a very good shot, he doesn't like pulling his gun unless he absolutely, absolutely has to.
Well, let's get a little bit into Monty's skills and abilities. Fasten has an archetype system, correct?
Yes.
It's similar to like a playbook or an occupation, like an occupation in Call of Cthulhu, or maybe a playbook in like a PBTA game, something like that.
A little bit, yeah.
What is his archetype?
Monty is a hunter.
And what does it mean to be a hunter?
It can be interpreted in many different ways. Sometimes it simply means that they were like an actual like hunter, like a big, like a wild game hunter beforehand. But it's generally, it means someone who is good at ferreting out information in the area, investigating and stuff like that, as well as someone who is a bit competent when it comes to when things turn a bit violent. Kind of like the closest thing you might even call like the more modern Sherlock Holmes movies with Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock in that is kind of akin to a hunter in that he's got these great investigative skills, but he's also fairly martially adept as well.
Going into that, what is Monty good at? How do skills and attributes work in this game?
You have your series of attributes, which is things like logic, empathy, precision. These are different things that you're going to, when you're rolling the dice, is how you're going to determine, you know, how well you do. So yeah, you have agility, close combat, force, medicine, range combat, stealth, investigation, learning, vigilance, inspiration, manipulation, and observation. And those come off of your attributes, which are physique, precision, logic, and empathy. You have the four, two physical, two mental. And you're rolling dice, and it's a D6 system. Anything that's a six is a success. So you have to roll a six. And that's all on a scale of how many successes did you get?
It's a dice pool, right?
Yeah, it's a dice pool. So, and most often, it's you're rolling, you know, only a couple of dice. And most of the time, normal action, you need one success on your dice. And your dice is, it's your attribute plus your skill. So if I have a three in logic and a three precision, I would roll six dice.
Okay. Yeah, I see that. And the scale goes from zero to, or I guess one would be the lowest. How high can a skill be?
Oh, boy. You know, I don't remember how high they can go because we don't advance that much.
I'm just kind of curious, how many dice could you possibly be rolling in one and run roll? Could you be rolling 10 or 12 dice?
I don't think you have 12. I think I've rolled 10. Maybe you can. I know I've rolled 10 before.
Wow.
Because okay. you can also get bonuses for stuff depending on the situation or if someone's helping you. And I will also add that every game I play, there is always a tremendous amount of home ruling just because we like to change things to the way that we like things to be. Because sometimes we want to make certain things a little easier. We also don't roll the dice a lot. Generally, if it's anything outside of combat that is not story changing, if it's within your wheelhouse, you can just do it. Just because the I'm trying to pick a lock and there's no one around. There's no rush for me to pick this lock. And I'm really good at picking locks. Making me roll for it when it's just a normal locked door that like a person has in their house, we're not going to bother with the roll of that. It just happens. Now, if it's I'm trying to do this quickly or quietly, or it's a really, really good lock, then sure, you roll. But we try to minimize our dice rolling because we like to focus a lot more on just the story that we're telling.
So then what is Monty good at? Is he good at precision, physique, logic? What kind of skills?
Monty is very good at precision and observation are two big things. So, and vigilance. Like your perception check and stuff like that is your vigilance. So those are his three biggest things that he's good at. The precision, because he did spend a lot of time as a young boy, he hunted and stuff like that. He just enjoyed shooting in general and practicing that skill. But then the observation and the vigilance are a lot from his investigating and just searching out information. Even as a boy, he was very inquisitive. And it's just kind of played over into his adulthood, and it's really served him well. Observation is his best ability. That's the one that he has a five in observation.
That makes a lot of sense when you were telling me about discovering the Selkie coat. There had to be a certain level of inquisitiveness that went into that discovery, right? He had to have a certain amount of curiosity to want to learn more about that story. And also, I think just, you know, if you're curious about somebody else and you want to learn their story, like that's a way to relate to them. So I think that's interesting that you're this kind of natural inquisitiveness.
Yeah. And part of it also came from the fact that because he was always questioning and always looking for information, he was able to, from a young age, tell when his mother was lying to him about something. Whether it was the good-natured lies we tell children like Santa Claus and stuff like that, or more insidious lies like, oh yeah, the girl that you've been growing up with, that you fall in love with, is actually a otherworldly creature that I captured and I'm holding here against her will from, you know, because I stole her from her mother when she was a child.
Let's get into that a little bit. His mother sounds like an interesting person. I'm very curious about her capturing this Selkie. How did that happen? And I guess also, why would she keep this creature captive?
His mother is a very jealous woman. She's jealous of anyone who has something that she does not. And at the time, she was in a marriage to a man she did not love, but she married him because the fact that this man had more money than her family did. So she married strictly out of a desire for access to his wealth. He was also a much older man. Her initial thoughts was that she'd be married for 5 to 10 years and he would die. And then she would take the wealth he had and then she could marry up from there again and constantly kind of move her way up. It is the late 1700s. In this game, it's 1800s now. But when, you know, when Monty was born, it was the late 1700s. Women don't have a lot of authority in the world. So a big thing for women is who they're married to, and that kind of gives them their position. So even if her husband died and she still had this money and stuff, she'd still be thought of as less than a man with this amount of wealth and land. But Monty's father lived a long time. Monty's father lived to be 97 years old, which for the 1700s is pretty darn long.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty darn long for today still, too. So instead of being married 5 or 10 years, she was married to this man for almost 30. Now she is a woman in her you know, late 50s, and it's made her very bitter. And she was bitter, you know, just with the fact that this man would not die. So she was always trying to find things that she could not find elsewhere. She also wanted more children, but Monty's father was well past the age of being able to give her children, both physically and just didn't have the desire. I mean, you know, at this point, Monty's father is, you know, pushing 75. So when she finds this young child alone on the beach at the moment, she just acts. She takes the child. She doesn't know what the sealskin is at first when she takes it, but she does some investigating of her own, and she finds out what this means because the child keeps trying to take it. And she then decides to lock it away in the attic. And then as this child grows up, Thea is, I mean, as it is with many creatures that are otherworldly, she is extraordinarily beautiful. And that just leads her to believe more and more that this woman is not just supernatural, but it is something that she can use. And if she can use it to marry off her son to this beautiful woman who has no ancestry that people can point to and say where she came from, she can craft. She was already planning on crafting some story about this woman being from some other country and being, you know, some type of aristocratic daughter that her son had been married to, because they was never left off the grounds either. I mean, she was kept under strict watch as she worked in the house. She rarely left the house. And if she did, she was under supervision. So his mother's not a good person. She's very manipulative and she's cruel.
You'd have to be really to imprison a young girl for so long. Did Monty grow up Christian?
He did, but not devoted Christian. It was a Christian household, but they did not attend services regularly and stuff like that. Generally, the Bible would only be brought out when his mother would be trying to reprimand him for some type of behavior he had engaged in as being improper. But as it is with many Bible-thumping Christians, they ignore the parts that condemn themselves, and she only used it to condemn him. So while he was raised Christian, he himself does not consider himself to be devoutly Christian. He believes that God exists, but he does not appreciate the directions the church itself takes.
Right. Do they have any connection to these kind of folkloric beliefs? How alive is the folklore in Monty's life growing up? I know all of these, you know, there's a lot of myths that we believe, Santa previously mentioned being one of them. And I don't believe in Santa. Santa is not like part of my spirituality. But when we're talking about a game that's dealing with kind of these traditional non-Christian folktales coming to life, I'm kind of curious how Monty and his family relate to that.
Monty's father was much different than his mother. He always told Monty stories. Unknown to Monty, his father also has the sight, or had the sight. His father has now passed away. And some of the stories his father was telling was not out of a Hans Christian Andersen book. It was things that he himself had experienced when he was a younger man. His father had been a bit of a soldier and had fought across Europe and had traveled a lot. And he had encountered trauma of his own at war, which is when he gained the sight. And he saw things in his travels. And then he kind of also just had the stories that he himself had grown up with, because he himself was born, you know, in the late 1600s, when, yes, there's still Christianity, but there's still a lot of that clinging to the old ways, especially being rural, which is what Monty's family was. And he told all those stories to his son. And Monty, being inquisitive, just ate that up.
You say they were rural. Do they still live in a rural area?
It is less rural now because it had been a type of place that was a couple of miles outside of a larger town, but that town has grown, and now it's more like it's a close suburb as opposed to being out in the country. It's, you know, it's slowly being eaten up by the city itself.
And you said that this was built for the new setting, which is Celtic?
Partly. The initial story started being formed before the book came out, and then the book has just added to it. So, because our GM, she lives in Scotland. She wanted to use the mythology and the landmarks that she herself was more familiar with. So all of our stuff was originally based out of Glasgow, as opposed to Uppsala in Sweden, which is where the original society is based.
So we're talking about a very different time period, but not, I'd say, again, and I keep comparing it to Call of Cthulhu, but there's a lot of things that are similar in terms of time period, and at least for, you know, kind of the classic Call of Cthulhu, that it's taking place in an earlier time, and it's fairly realistic with like this kind of magical element or this, you know, cosmic horror element being brought in. And here we're talking about a fairly realistic setting where folklore and all of these kind of monsters and things are alive. Has it been difficult for you to build a character that is in a different time period that and has beliefs and customs that are perhaps a little alien to us?
I don't think I would say it's difficult. Our game master in this, you know, she has been kind to us in, you know, the fact that one of the guys tries to speak with a Scottish accent, which is, it's an okay American Scottish accent, but, you know, when you're dealing with someone who's actually Scottish, but she humors us in a lot of stuff in that way. But she's also given us feedback on some things when we would come up with our backgrounds for our characters as the things that fit more with kind of how she grew up, because she grew up in the countryside in Scotland outside of Glasgow. To make things, you know, fit a bit more with the location and stuff like that, and just general attitudes. But I mean, it's just, I think while it is based on a real locations, there's still enough of that element of the make-believe where there's a lot of room to explore. We're not pretending to be African or Chinese, where it could easily very quickly become very culturally insensitive and inappropriate. With exception of one person, I mean, everyone playing the game, we're all either white, and the one person who isn't white is the GM, but she's, you know, she grew up in Scotland. She's born and raised in Scotland. We all come from a very Western perspective. So it's the stuff that we kind of already know to a degree, even though it's a different time. A lot of the morals and stuff haven't changed a whole bunch. It was a lot stricter back then, just in some degrees, but the thing is, you still see people who are still very much like that in their belief systems of what is and isn't acceptable behavior in society. So it's not too big of a stretch to just see what that time would be like.
In your submission, you mentioned that this character came out of a piece of writing that you're doing, a short story. Is that something that you do often?
Quite often. I have more unfinished stories than I have had breaths in life.
That's a lot. you just wrote another one.
I get little ideas and I jot them down, and then sometimes they grow beyond a sentence. Sometimes they'll be a couple pages. I mean, sometimes they're longer because I do like NaNoWriMo, the National Novel Writing Month. I do that every year. So, and a lot of my characters either grow from those stories or my stories grow from the characters. But yeah, Monty was born out of a short story I was working on where I had just finished reading a book called Meeting the Other Folk. It's all Irish tales by a man named Eddie Lenihan, who, if you were to look him up online and see pictures of him, you'd be like, that's a guy who talks about mythology. I've always had an interest in mythology, particularly British and Germanic and Scandinavian myth. And I had books on that growing up as a child. And reading this book, it rekindled a lot of that interest for me. I mean, it never went away, but it like really lit a bigger fire under me. And I started reading on some of the other creatures that existed in mythology. And I've always liked Selkies. It also came a bit from a World of Darkness game I've been playing online for a long, long time that blends all of the World of Darkness games. So it blends vampire and werewolf and changeling all into one mass. And in that game, I'd been playing a fairy character, a fae character, for a long, long time. And Selkies were never allowed in the game. And I just had just introduced them. So between my old research and then just coming back up, it prompted me again. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to tell a story about a Selkie. I don't know. I just find it really interesting. And there's a great Vessin podcast called, I always get it wrong, it's like Last Mountain Podcast, something like that. And they just had an episode recently on Selkies as well. So I'm like, this is much like the idea that I had when I came up with Monty.
I'll drop a link to that in the description so that if you're curious, you can go check out that other podcast. I'm curious. I might go check it out myself. We've talked a little bit about how he gained the sight and how he joined the society. He's currently on a quest to find a way to kind of join this kind of other world that his wife is a part of, being a Selkie. You would say that is his kind of central motivation for being out adventuring in the world.
Yeah. As I said, he grew up with this woman, been in love since they were, you know, young teenagers, where they actually understood that this was love and not just we grew up together. And obviously his child as well, that he loved dearly. Because Monty also thought for a long time that he was never going to find that because of the fact of the scarring on his face. I mean, his mother used that many times to berate him and that, you know, he was useless because no one would ever marry him. And yeah, trying to find some way to rejoin his wife and child is what really drives him, even though he knows that it's most likely never going to happen.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's on a quest that may never be fruitful. It takes a great deal of optimism.
It definitely does.
Would you say that Monty is in general an optimistic fellow?
He is. And a lot of that grew out of the relationship he had with Thea, because without her in his life, he could have very easily turned out much more like his mother, who is not an optimist. She's an opportunist.
I know that his story hasn't been written yet, but in your head, is there a way for him to join his wife and daughter's world?
In my head, there is not. The best he will ever get is he will catch glances of them sometimes. You know, perhaps if he's by the sea, he may see some seals and, you know, there'll be that part of him that'll be like, that's them. In my heart, I would love for him to have that reunion and to find a way to join them. But in my head, I think it's a fool's quest that will never come to fruition. It'll never bear fruit.
That's kind of a devastatingly sad choice to make as a player for your characters, to give them an incredibly meaningful but unattainable errand to pursue.
As I'll play him, my hope is, it's not quite the word. My idea is that the longer he's denied this, it'll slowly chip away at that optimism. And he'll become a bit more jaded and a bit more bitter as he grows and realizes that he's never going to get what he wants. And then he'll slowly turn that anger on the world around him.
I think that a lot of times we kind of expect, or, you know, maybe pursue it. There's nothing wrong at all with starting a character with a lot of flaws who then grows and learns to overcome those flaws. And you're kind of going the opposite direction in that you're starting with a character who is optimistic and hoping may actually be the best word, hoping that they come to a point where that is challenged and where that could actually change their character for the worse. Hoping for that isn't necessarily saying that you want that to happen in the real world, but you hope that your character will have an arc of some sort. Is that something that you often do, is having these kind of negative character arcs, or kind of allowing or wanting your characters to go down a road that's maybe not bettering themselves?
I like exploring that at times, and games, I think, like a game like Vesten or Call of Cthulhu, I think can lend itself well to that type of character arc. And it is not unheard of in this group I play with for former characters to end up as BBEGs in later games we play, because they've been chipped away so much that they become the villain themselves. I mean, it's that old saying of, as a hero, if you live too long, you become the villain. I like playing that sometimes. I mean, I like the redemption arc too, but I like to change it up sometimes. And I like to have it where there's this possibility that this character is setting themselves up for a huge fall. There's also the hope that the course of the game and the course of the other players pulls them out of that.
Yeah, that's an important point, is that you may have a very specific goal or idea of what your character's arc may be, but the other players and the DM are going to change it. They're going to throw a wrench into your plans. It's a great viewpoint to have to say, you know what, this may change. And I love that you're thinking of that right from the start.
My thought now is if I were to play this character through a series of campaigns till it ended, it would end up one of two ways. Well, one of three ways. One is he ends up dead. I mean, it's always a possibility in these games. But the other two ways is that he somehow manages through whatever miraculous means to get that reunion. And that's the least likely scenario. The other thought is that he eventually gets ejected from the society because his ways have shifted from being peaceful and understanding to being more barbaric. I'm curious to see what the future will hold for Monty. I have hope in my heart that it'll be positive, but there's the thoughts in my head that are like, you know, I've set this character up to do nothing but go down.
Well, yeah, I mean, he seems to be starting off in a very positive place. I mean, wanting to not just kill every monster that he encounters, you know, trying to find peaceful solutions when possible. Seems like he has a lot of empathy and curiosity about his fellow man. What would you say at this point, this early point in the story, what are his flaws?
He does have a blind spot to danger because he's so focused on finding that peaceful solution that he can be manipulated. And many of the Vesson are masters at manipulation. So we can fall prey to that a bit too easily at times. And he does not deal well with bullies. The one time that will really drive him to become angry is when he encounters someone who is a bully. At times he will become physically violent with people that are bullied, because he grew up with his mother. That was his mother's entire life.
Both in your character and in the world that the game is set in and depicts, there's this idea of how evil is defined by your perspective. For example, the Vesson, these monsters are not necessarily just outright evil, that they may be responding to an evil that has been done to them or a way that the world has changed that hurts them. And you could say that with his mother's actions, that trying to find a way to provide for herself in a world that doesn't give her many options from within the family, it is evil. He sees the evil and he is affected by it. But from the outside world, it doesn't really look the same. So it seems like there's a lot of play with that kind of outside inside perspective and how perspective changes morality or how you look at somebody else's morality.
Oh, absolutely. That you can lean a lot of different ways. So if you wanted to, you could lean hard into the, as it always is, as the world changes, there are those who are reluctant to adapt to the change. And in this case, it's not, you know, it's not your grandparents, it's the Vesson, who are reluctant to the changes coming to the world. As the world becoming more modern, they have their own set ways and they don't want to change that. does that mean that the modern ways are all evil or not? Because, I mean, you know, it's, you can say there's aspects of it that would be, but it's like modern medicine evil. I mean, can't really argue that. But the thing is, there are changes that improve the lives of humans. But in this case, it comes at the cost of affecting the Vessen. So, I mean, you can lean into that way, or you can lean into the fact that our games that we've generally played in the world of Vessen leans much more in the church is overbearing and is very vehemently against anything that is not overtly Christian. So they are kind of waging their silent war against the Vessen. Sometimes silent, sometimes not, depending on where you are. The more rural you are, the more vocal the preachers get. The game lends itself to a lot of different ways that you could interpret it.
So let's go into Monty's characteristics, his kind of his basic stats, so to speak. We already said he's in his 30s. He's a hunter. He has a scar on his face. Can you describe his appearance a little bit more?
Monty was attacked by a dog when he was a young boy, and he was mauled. The entire left of his face is just a series of scars from, I mean, in essence, half his face chewed off by a dog. Mm. So the doctors, you know, being the late 1700s, did the best they could. But I mean, the whole side of his left side of his face is just a ruined mass of scarred flesh. It doesn't look like he can see out of his left eye, but he can because it's very cloudy. That ended up playing into the story is that eye improved when he gained the sight. We played that up to kind of add a bit more to the mystical of having the sight. He physically he's not a very imposing man, except when he's angry. When he gets angry, it seems like he gets bigger. When he wants to exude a larger presence, he can. But he's average build, nothing spectacular about him. He's healthy. He's not like ripped muscle man or anything like that. He keeps his hair cropped short. He dresses in very simple garb that you would expect someone who is constantly on the road to wear. He does not keep much possessions. He leads a very, very simple life, which is much different than him growing up. He was by no means rich, but he was well off growing up. Never had needs that weren't met, and he had many of his wants fulfilled.
You said that this is taking place in Scotland. Are you doing an accent for this one? Will you be doing an accent?
I am not. Monty just talks a bit more gruff, so this is the voice I generally use for Monty. My Scottish accent is not great, and the fact that the GM is Scottish...
Right.
I feel like it'd be, like I said, she's fine with us doing whatever we want, but I don't know. I would just feel kind of foolish doing it around her. I've learned so many different ways that the Scottish people speak, and it really knowing her, I've known her for about 9 years now, and just having talked with her over the years, it's not just doing an accent. It's not just having your voice sound like someone's from there. It's the words they use, because the Scottish have so much slang. I mean, Americans have a fair amount, but oh my gosh, the Scottish just, wow, wow.
I feel like they probably think the same thing about Americans, though. From the outside, it always, you know. Of course, everybody knows American slang because we're so dominant. Did you do any research slang of the period?
I always do on lots of different things. But the thing is, I don't use them that often, because even if I know what it is, the odds are the other players don't. And even though it helps fit the feel of the game, if you confuse other players, it takes them out of the game. Because I've learned tons of slang because I run a lot of Call of Cthulhu. So I know a lot of 1920s slang, but most people don't know that stuff. So I don't use a lot of it. I mean, there's some that everybody knows, you know, that just kind of linger. Everyone knows if you say, you know, gams, a lot of people know that means legs.
Yeah.
But even that can leave, you know, especially some of the younger players, they're not going to know what that is. No one uses the word anymore unless you're playing into that stereotype from, you know, the 1920s or wherever.
I'm in my early 40s and I know what gams are, but I would not expect anybody younger than me to know, because I feel like for me, it was very antiquated. It sounds like, obviously, you do a lot of writing. You're writing RPGs, you're writing novels, you're writing short stories with every breath. Is research a big part of the writing that you do? Or are you bringing that into creating characters for games as well?
Sometimes a lot of stuff I write is loosely based on real stuff. There's often been a thing like for games like when you're not playing in a real world setting, where someone will be doing an accent, someone will say, "Oh, that's not a very good British accent." And my reply would always be, "I'm not British. I'm an elf from the Gurney countryside. So this is how an elf from the Gurney countryside sounds. What's British?" So I do a little bit at times. A lot of my research is just simply reading. I take ideas from everywhere, from books and comics and TV and movies as well. But I do have some sources I use for research, like sometimes with the slang, or I'll do research on a location. If I'm setting something in a specific location, that's going to be a long-term setting, or I'll try to get some things that actually existed in that time period. If I'm doing anything historic, I try to make sure I don't introduce things that don't exist yet. Obviously, like in Call of Cthulhu, I mean, they have phones, but not everyone has a phone. It's the 1920s. Not everyone has electricity, but a lot of people do. Knowing those types of things that I think can help in the game, where it leads more to the atmosphere without being confusing like slang would be.
The spark for Monty came from some folklore that you're reading and this interest in this Selkie tale. Is that a common way that you come up with characters? Are the sparks coming from things that you're reading, or are they coming from a lot of different places?
Sometimes it's from things that I'm reading. I'd say probably a third or so comes from stuff that I'm reading. The rest of it comes from when I'm writing, I'll be writing something and I'll come up with an idea that doesn't fit the story I'm in, and I'll just jot that note down. And a lot of characters have grown out of those sparks as well.
Do you have a notebook of character ideas that just waiting to be adapted?
Notebook would be a rather organized way of saying it. I have Google Docs and Microsoft Notes and Post-it notes and file folders and napkins with ideas scribbled on that I every now and then try to organize and just never get very far.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember all of them?
No. No, I'll come across some fragment of a note and I'm like, what did I mean by Waffle King? Who's the Waffle King? What am I talking about, Waffle King?
Well, shoot, I'm going to make a character who's the Waffle King. That's a great idea.
Yeah, but I mean, in some ways, I won't remember, and in trying to remember, I'll spark some different idea.
That's true.
What could the Waffle King, what could I have meant by this? That's how I got inspiration for a character I ran in Call of Cthulhu, where I was a mobster who was known as the Waffle King.
I love that. Monty, who do you look up to?
Oh, who do I look up to? That's a... I mean, when as a boy, it would have always been my father. He was, I mean, despite being a very old man my entire childhood, he was that larger-than-life kind of figure. I didn't realize at the time, but the stories he told me and the way he treated me, I think in a lot of ways shaped the man I am today. So probably, like, looking back, that's who I looked up to then, and I still respect my father a lot and what he taught me. As far as today, I would have to say my wife, Thea. She showed me how love can really change a person. Even in a bad situation, it can shine above that darkness. And it can drive you in ways and motivate you in ways that you never thought you could. I miss her.
Glenn, thank you so much for sharing your character with me today and with my listeners. How can people find you? What kind of projects would you like to tell them about?
I am on most social medias as Games in a Bunker, all one word. Twitter, Instagram, Hive, TikTok, all over the place. As far as my games, I have an itch page that currently has Mistrunner for free on it because it was the first game I made and I see lots of flaws in it. So you can go grab it for free.
I'll put the link to the itch store in the description.
As far as what I'm working on now, I'm kind of leaning into Powered by the Apocalypse for rule settings, because making your own rule set is really hard. It's a lot of work, and it's a lot of a lot of playtesting. I mean, you still playtest even when you're using an existing system, but a lot of the kinks have already been worked out for you.
Right.
So I have two games I'm kind of working on a bit right now. The first is Demon Eater, which is a Eldritch Apocalypse game set after the world kind of met a end, as it were, when the supervolcano at Yellowstone erupted. And unknown to everyone, there was an ancient cosmic entity that had fallen to Earth there. And when the volcano erupted, it spread this thing's bits everywhere, which kind of began to corrupt everything. So there's that one. And the other one is Eden Adrift, where you are on a lost colony ship in space, and it has been adrift for 1,000 years. And you are the people who have grown out of the original crew. The planet, the sun that they relied on, was dying. And this was their escape plan, as they built these arcs, these colony ships that they sent off. And this one encountered a problem along the way. They can't wake up any of the original people who were in cryostasis. They got trapped on this ship. And they had kids, and those kids had kids, and it's grown beyond that.
Those both sound really interesting. I especially like the ship. That's a really interesting idea.
I need to go back to that one and work on it more.
You can find me on TikTok at StarMamaC. That's StarMamaC. You can also listen on YouTube. Just search for Characters Without Stories or follow the link in the description. Please like, subscribe, rate, review, and share with your friends. I am just starting out, and I can't adequately express how much it means to me that you've given me some of your valuable and limited time. Thank you. If you'd like me to send you a free button, email me at characterswithoutstories@gmail.com with your address and something you like about the podcast. And if you write a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, I'll give you a shout out on the show. I'm currently accepting submissions, particularly for non-D&D characters. So if you'd like to share your character, you can go to the submission form at characterswithoutstories.com. Thanks for listening, and may all your characters find their stories.